Welcome to Rise Up at Work. I'm Dr. Deepak Boothra, and today we are unlocking the work life you were meant to live. You're watching Now Media Television.
Welcome to Rise Up at Work. I'm your host, Dr. Deepak Boothra. Throughout my career, I've been leading global operations. I've learned that building a high-performance workforce requires us to look deeper than just technical training university degrees. In fact, the search starts very early. And when this search starts, we're looking at people that can truly bring organizational agility, which is rooted in core human attributes like adaptability, creativity, and resilience. Traits that are formed long before anyone signs an employment contract. This is a very powerful session that we're going to have today. Think about it. We will explore the deep human foundation of the future professional success. How many of us think about that? We believe that careers start at age 21 when you join the workforce. I have today a very special guest, Kayanga Giano. A masterful, yes, I use that word, a masterful strategic leader and expert in human capital, talent transformation, systemic organizational change. And she is based in South Africa, and I really wanted to bring more diverse voices to this table. She brings to this table something because she is very good. She's committed her career, her life to analyzing how early development and learning environments shape long-term human potential, confidence, as well as career capability. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm putting in a lot of effort at working with early to mid-career talent. She's actually connecting the dots for us and actually making us realize that even before you join the workforce, there's a lot happening that you need to be aware of. Kayang, welcome to Rise Up at Work. It's just an honor. It's a pleasure to have you share your insights with my global audience today.
Hi, Deepak. Thank you so much for having me here. And I think we're going to get into a very good discussion together.
I know. I can feel it in my bones, as we say, right? So Kayang, let me start off with just making sure that the viewers can hear about the work you do, right? Many of them don't know the type of work you do. And many of them who join my sessions usually will find this session a bit obtuse because they can't connect the dots. What exactly is the work you do and why is it so important in shaping future generations? Give an outline to the listeners.
So I work for a local South African tech for good organization, which is called the Reach Trust. So Deepak, I think every country, every environment is different. But here in South Africa, we face an educational crisis. And the let me preface that by saying that my own background is more in communications than in early childhood development per se. But what has happened in the course of my career over the last 5 years is that I have realized the importance of analyzing human capital according to how people develop the soft skills, specifically deep listening and self-expression. And this has taken me into working for this organization, the Reach Trust, where we are trying to build tech solutions that are conduits for access to education right through from the early years of a child's life, where we are supporting parents in their children's development through to youth employability.
So let's talk about this transition, right? There's a lot of things that I just heard there, but I really want to dig into youth employability because that's the first marker that connects to the work that I do when it comes to career. We are talking on Rise Up at Work. And when we look at that word Rise Up at Work, I think you're talking about that the rising up actually, Deepak, starts just before people even get into the workforce. So let's talk about youth employability. I think a lot of people on this call think that early childhood development is only about preparing children for school, but you just threw in youth employability. What are we missing when we think about it that narrowly? What's the bigger picture for us to look at?
Well, I think the thing that we need to look at is that the ages from birth, 0 to age 5, are when 90% of a human brain's development takes place. So that means that all the foundational neural pathways are being formed during that time. And in order for those pathways to be strong in the right kinds of areas, to build human resilience, to develop socio-emotional skills, and of course, our intellectual development as human beings.
Yes.
If those pathways are not being fostered and stimulated, and if the brain is not receiving adequate stimulation, you are sitting with an underdeveloped brain. Now, the environment that we are raised in is not a simple environment. We have a lot of inputs coming at us. But if we look at the core home environment, if there is no stability, emotional stability in that environment in our early years, and if there is not access to developing our intellectual skills, as well as our ability to emotionally regulate ourselves, we are going to carry that with us for the rest of our lives. And we will also, our brains will not be able to learn adequately if they have not learned to do so before the age of five. And I think that speaks to the fact that, go ahead.
Think about it, Kang. Here I am sitting here listening, and I tell people, if you're in sales, I talk about mental resilience. I talk about being mentally resilient in the moment. I never talk about, if we were to look at the next generation of salespeople and we actually realize that by the time they come to us, we have already maybe theoretically lost the battle, Kang, listening to you, because the work that really needs to start to prepare the great salesperson or great professional at work happens earlier. I have a question for you then. I mean, one of the things that I was reading when I was trying to prep for this call was that you talk about play as a serious vehicle for learning. What exactly are we talking about? Because I'm not sure what type of capabilities are children actually building through play that would help them as an adult later in life and in work. Could you connect the dots for me on that one?
Absolutely. So Deepak, the research shows us that as human beings, the best way for us to learn is through play. And what play means is creative exploration. So that can be physical play or mental play or a combination of the two. So if we think about ourselves as youngsters, if we're taken down to the lowest common denominator, sticks and stones, you're sitting with a few sticks and a few stones, you can do all sorts of things with them. You can build little structures, you can do counting, you can do sequencing. If we learn through exploration, and if we learn, we're given room to maneuver, and it's the opposite of rote learning. It takes only 10 to 20 repetitions for us to learn something. Whereas when we learn in the traditional rote way, it takes up to 400 repetitions for us to learn something new. Does that help to explain what we're talking about?
It does. In fact, now that also explains why we have such a powerful team building, you know, external events that companies spend so much money on, because we ultimately do realize that, you know, taking people into, let's say, safer place, doing stuff that is more, let's put it to you, non-work related, right? I don't think that many of us are going to learn how to be better human beings by learning how to do Excel sharper. To me, that's just one of those things. So I think I'm understanding. I personally have grown a lot over time, Kang, in terms of relationships, in terms of building bonds, by actually doing this type of work outside of the traditional work environment as well, right? So when you use the word play, a lot of people might be thinking about marbles and stuff, and I think you're giving a bigger context there. The same concept at the child's level is maybe marbles and sticks and stones, as you called it, right? And it could become slightly more intricate. But this is really interesting. So now, if we were to just push this, right? I look at kids growing up today, right? And I'm very sure that my parents looked at my generation and said, oh, this is a useless generation. I'm sure we look at our next generation and say, this is a useless generation. I think it's just one of those curses, right? Handed down generation to generation. What I wanted to check with you is that, looking at where we are today, right, in the socioeconomic climate, and it's not unique to South Africa, and the fact that we have smartphones, pervasive devices, AI, right? Oh, what worries you most about these environments in which many of our children are now growing up today, especially in this rapidly changing and increasing digital world that I just spoke about? What caution would you give us, ma'am?
Well, I think the first caution I would give you is that every generation tends to demonize and catastrophize the technological changes that come with the new epoch, right? So like 4IR, the fourth industrial revolution, and the effect that's having on youngsters. So I am not as concerned about the technological and screen interface of children with devices and with technology, as I am concerned about the anxiety and the catastrophizing. If you have an anxious parent who is judging a child or being critical around how much time a child spends on a screen, the adult's judgment and anxiety is going to have a far more detrimental effect on the child than how much time they're exposed to a screen. So that's the first thing I'd like to say. The only thing I think that worries me about screen time is how sedentary it tends to be. And I think that it's very important for all of us that we remain physically active. Most of us spend 8 to 10 hours on a laptop or on a device doing the work that we do, right? If we're looking at white collar work, if we're looking at the world of work for office workers or you know, people like ourselves. And I think that is something that we just need to be very cognizant of. Don't demonize, try not to be anxious around screens, but just make sure that there's physical movement in a young person's life. And in
I would agree with that. Yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, every time you talk about children, I'm actually extrapolating it because I just realized the advice you're giving is sage advice, not just for youngsters, but for teenagers. And then, as you said, youth employment. And then, of course, anyone who's early career should actually be listening very carefully and leaning in right now. So I'm going to start up wrapping this segment up. I think this was a great conversation. An enterprise cannot achieve sustainable external scaling, and those are big words, if it ignores the fundamental architecture of human behavior. And I think Kayang is helping us understand that the strengths we bring to the office are built on the foundations laid early in life, very early. Do not move an inch. When we return from this brief break, Kayang and I will unpack how these developmental experiences dictate adult workplace confidence and corporate execution. And I think that's a great topic. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with real stories, fresh insights, and action steps to help you rise up at work without losing yourself. You're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Your ambition built your success, but somewhere along the way, your ambition took over and started running you. Hi, I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra. I'm an executive coach, sales strategist, and host of Rise Up at Work. I've spent 3 decades inside corporate walls, a long time. I've been witness to how pressure rewrites purpose. And when you lose sight of purpose, how the right mindset can help you reset and write a greater story. Rise Up at Work premieres soon on Now Media Television. Remember, it's time to move from surviving to thriving. It's time to rise up at work. And we're back. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra, and you're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Let's keep reclaiming your career and learning how to truly rise up at work.
Welcome back to Rise Up at Work. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra, and I'm sitting down with human capital authority Kayang Agyano, mapping out how early development impacts the modern corporate landscape. I wrote a book, and in my book, Rise Up Your Career Reclaimed, I wrote extensively about taking proactive ownership of your career path and performance. For organizations, this means leadership must understand that professional confidence, communication skills, and fear of failure are always tied to an individual's psychological and emotional safety networks. In an automated world, our raw technical skills will constantly need to be updated, but our core human capabilities will remain our greatest competitive assets. And this is a message in there for everyone who thinks that AI will take their job, right? AI will take a job if you allow it to. Judgment remains with you. What Kayang is doing is actually bringing a lens which says, hey, when you talk about careers, the journey starts earlier. So Kayang, let's explore how adult workplace behaviors can be traced back to early learning environments and how managers listening in can design spaces that foster real emotional intelligence. So Kayang, let me start off with a very simple question. How much of what we see in adult workplaces today can actually be traced back to developmental experiences earlier in life? I mean, this sounds like one of those, you know, touchy-feely, psychologically questions that you would do to someone on a couch. But I'm very intrigued listening to you because I have a feeling that you're going to say quite a lot, aren't you?
Well, yes, given the opportunity. I think that really all of it can be traced back to early childhood development. When we look at human beings in terms of our evolutionary biology, because we are a highly social species, we are designed to, and this is what a, you know, a reality show like Survivor speaks to. Everything we do to survive means that we want to stay part of the group. We want to prevent rejection or ostracization, because if a human being is left on their own and they're no longer part of the group, they cannot protect themselves, they cannot gather resources for their survival. which means that the way that we are showing up in the workplace will be based on our social experiences in the sandpit as children. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Because I think bringing in the survivor angle actually just made a little light bulb go off in my brain. Because sometimes we are surrounded by so much that we need someone to actually connect the dots, and then you see an image or a pattern. That was very helpful. So if I am looking at my own kids and the way I raise them, right? Well, I have come to a simple conclusion that even despite in my thinking, I did my best, but sometimes I have conversations with my 28 and 24 year old when they come back from work, and it still sounds like the same issues I faced, Guyang. They talk about lack of confidence, they talk about feedback, communication, and the same fears that I had 30 years ago when I was 21, they seem to do the same again. So the question to you is, why do so many young professionals, including my two sons, struggle with confidence, feedback, communication, fear of failure once they enter the workforce? What changes?
I think this is a very complicated question and a very complex phenomenon. So the first part of this for me is that I think that we live in a society now where children are not really taught grit and resilience. And I know, Deepak, this is something you speak to a lot. But we have this thing now of the participation medal. We have a thing of where we're trying to avoid building a meritocracy. But the problem with that is children are not given the opportunity to fail. And we know that failure is our biggest teacher. And if you're not used to failure and you haven't failed, you fear it. And that then makes you insecure. Whereas what we really need to be doing is cultivating environments where young people are not afraid to fail and to learn, which brings me to the other part of my response, which is to speak to workplace culture. I think that workplace cultures, because of traditional line management and corporate structures, do not allow people to show up and say, I'm struggling to understand this. I'm struggling to do this. And I think that becomes a rabbit chasing its own tail.
Oof. Wait. There's so much goodness in that, Kang. I really need to unbox that a bit here. You kind of brought a very interesting light to this, right? The point that I wanted to check with you is on. So I have walked into the workplace and I am now having issues and challenges, and there is potentially a certain stigma attached to it, which makes it very problematic. Could you elaborate a bit more as to the type of stigmas you have seen, experienced, and maybe talk a bit about mental health, if that could be possible, Kang?
Absolutely. Deepak, I mean, I'm a woman. I'm 52 years old. I've lived in South Africa for most of my life. I have lived and worked as an expatriate in some other countries. But there really is a lot going on here. Yes, there's a lot of stigma around mental health issues, but we are still facing stigmas around culture, language, society, and also ageism. We are in multicultural, but also multi-generational workplaces. And I think a lot of the insecurity and the anxiety that we see is because people from different cultures, different generations, and different backgrounds don't really understand one another. They don't have the insights around how they think and feel. And I think everyone is masking, Deepak. I think that's really what's happening.
Oof. I would agree with that. In fact, I was listening to a podcast yesterday, and it was a weird situation. They were talking about the layoffs that were happening in the IT world, right? And the podcast said that he had taped an interview which he cannot air anymore because the person had a breakdown on the call. This person was a VP for a very large Silicon Valley IT company whose name he cannot mention. This VP was just let go at a 6 a.m. email, and I think I just gave away the name of the company. And he was mentioning that this guy actually, despite 17, 18 years of hard work and everything, said that he came back to ground zero. He actually felt that his confidence was destroyed. He was scared to go for interviews. And that actually made me hesitate a bit, because here we are telling the whole world that work hard, get promoted, and you'll survive. And now your survival is, and he has to fall back not on everything he learned at work, but most likely fall back on skills that are supposed to have built his DNA the right way. To me, that actually blew my mind, Kayan. And I think as I listened to, I actually realized a lot of people think that they can learn about this stuff on the job. And I think that's the problem, because when you try to learn this on the job, you're actually exposing yourself to that lame leadership that has to promote you. And you cannot be as honest and open in your opinion as you think you can be. Whereas when you are growing up and when you have the conversations, I think there's a lot of protection that parents, other people can give to children so that they develop better. And I think that's a very big resonating point that I'm trying to pick up, and I want to just emphasize to people listening in, is that how do we then make sure that the same protection that we give to a child who's developing, we give the same protection to a 21, 25-year-old in the corporate workplace who may have all these stigmas, all these concerns, that if I say too much or if I concede that I have a mental challenge or that I am confused, will that hold up my progression? Will that make people think ill of me? And I think that there's a challenge there. I honestly believe that. I do a lot of coaching with Kayang, and I tell you, the amount of stories I hear from early career people telling me about how lost they feel and how unapproachable the managers are, it got me thinking about how can I help them in that situation. And as I listened to you, I actually realized the story of the journey starts very early. And I'm very tempted to tell you that I'm very keen to go back and look at my own work to see how I could potentially intercept some of these in an earlier phase. But that's for another day. I'm going to bring this conversation back to something that's, I would say, a hot topic, Kayang, right? We are talking about an AI-driven future. Now, earlier you said, and this is very remarkable how you actually said, you're not scared about smartphones or smart screens. You are actually scared more about what does it mean and what does happen to a sedentary lifestyle, because you believe that there's a basic understanding that people can figure that out because we have had waves of technical development along the way. But with AI, Kang, I feel something different, right? I feel that we're getting answers too fast, too quick. Answers that would have actually helped us develop our cognitive abilities are now being just given to us without thinking too much. And when you get that answer so fast, so quick, you get excited. No one even stops to ask, how did you bake this cake so neatly? What ingredients did you put in it? Are there any meat products in it in case you're a vegan? So in an AI-driven future where technical skills will constantly evolve, what human capabilities do you believe, Kayang, will become even more valuable that my audience should focus on at this point?
I would say critical thinking skills and making sure, and I've been reading a lot about AI and the interface and the role it should play in our lives as professionals. It is a thinking partner, but you do not relinquish your critical thinking and let the AI do your thinking for you. You rather have a conversation with the large language model or whatever, you know, form of AI it is that you're engaging with. I also think that the real skill that we need to be concentrating on is developing our communication skills. And something that I have found is a continuous area of work for me is deep listening. I really believe in my bones that the better we listen and the deeper we listen, the more resilient we will be in any workplace.
I like the sound of that, because, you know, we in the corporate world are inundated with terms, and there's a couple of courses also called active listening, right? And I've been a huge fan and a huge proponent. But for some reason, Kayang, I actually prefer deep learning, because the word deep actually tells you that you're actually going very deep into those places where you typically wouldn't take your listening skills to. You're going into a place, you're going to do something different. I like that. So Kang, I've really enjoyed this conversation, but last question for you, and a quick one. If organizations want more adaptable, right, individuals, emotionally intelligent, resilient employees in the future, what's that one thing they need to start paying attention to right now?
I think, and this goes back to listening, I think that in most companies, whether they are startups, SMEs, or large corporate organizations, their induction processes are quite flawed. I think that they need to take more time to really define their own company culture and then define the position of someone who is being onboarded within that culture. And I think that they need to have more town halls. I think that because things are changing so rapidly, it's very important to have people at all levels and tiers within the organization sitting together once a month, once every 6 weeks, to talk about what is happening out there and how the company is being affected, but also how the individuals, the human resources within that company are being affected.
Thank you. So, Kayang, I'm going to wrap up because I see you're on a roll. Let's move on to the next segment. Stay with us, because after the break, we will connect education directly to long-term economic mobility and leadership readiness. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with real stories, fresh insights, and action steps to help you rise up at work without losing yourself. You're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Your ambition built your success, but somewhere along the way, your ambition took over and started running you. Hi, I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra. I'm an executive coach, sales strategist, and host of Rise Up at Work. I've spent 3 decades inside corporate walls, a long time. I've been witness to how pressure rewrites purpose. And when you lose sight of purpose, how the right mindset can help you reset and write a greater story. Rise Up at Work premieres soon on Now Media Television. Remember, it's time to move from surviving to thriving. It's time to rise up at work. And we're back. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra, and you're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Let's keep reclaiming your career and learning how to truly rise up at work.
You're watching Rise Up at Work. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra. I'm joined today by talent transformation specialist Kayanga Gyano. Throughout my decades directing multinational portfolios, I have had the privilege of observing firsthand that human development is never just an isolated social issue. It is a critical macroeconomic and workforce priority. It has huge impact. When developmental and learning inequalities persist, they eventually show up as massive gaps in employability, career progression, and leadership readiness across industries. And for me, the cost of a disengaged employee is massive. True structural renewal actually requires a shared commitment across organizations, partnerships, innovators, and employers that can help build equitable futures for the next generation of professionals. And those professionals listening in right now, Kayang and I are going to make sure that you get some nuggets from this that explain what exactly are organizations still completely misunderstanding about human potential, and why should business leaders care deeply about the early learning systems in our communities? It's a very different angle. So let's get going. Kayang, I'd like to open this segment with I think it's a straightforward question, but let's see what the world thinks about it. Why should business leaders and employers care deeply about early childhood development and learning systems? You might want to recap some of the things we've said, but I really want you to just bucket that. Give me something that I can take back to my audience. Why should business leaders and employers care deeply about early childhood development and learning systems? So what?
Because 90% of the person that's showing up as your employee has been formed before the age of 5. So, you know, we all talk about our inner child. Really, what we are saying is that 90% of who we are is that inner child. And therefore, it is very important to understand the foundations that have formed a person in our employ. And if we go back and look at the gaps, we are then able to perhaps support them. And as much as we think about ourselves computationally, we really need to be focused more on what has happened to us emotionally in those early years, I would say.
I like that. I think that's a great t-shirt slogan, right? Computational, emotional. I like that switcheroo there that you did there. So here's the fun part though, right? You walk up to an employer and you say to an employer that we believe that what happens in the first 5 years, he'll cut you off. She will cut you off. And they'll say, that's not our responsibility. How can we actually do this? So, I mean, look, at the end of the day, there's a certain inequality in the process. An employer cannot tell you how he can intercept early. He doesn't know what to do. But I do believe that there's a bigger message here, right? It's not only about the employers, it's about the ecosystem. It's about people who are willing to invest in early stage developmental. Now, as you go around looking for funding and, you know, challenges to get resources to do help the work that you do, I just wanted to really touch upon this inequality question. How does developmental inequality eventually show up in career progression, employability, leadership readiness, and economic mobility later in life? You know, it's like the privileged. Some get it, some don't.
I'm sorry for interrupting you. How it shows up is that we are sitting with people that essentially are dealing with trauma. We're all dealing with trauma, and trauma is a reality of life. But the problem is that when people's brains are not developed in a way that they can actually deal with trauma, they end up hiding and lying and suppressing. And I think that's really the issue. So if employers want to support their employees, they don't want to drill down into what happened to that specific individual in their specific environment in the early years, What we need to be doing is recognizing that those gaps might be there, but create the space for vulnerability.
Ooh, now you've just opened another can of worms, vulnerability. And I think I got my answer, because I was very skeptical as to how do I go and tell an employer to hold themselves accountable for something that they had no control over from an early development point of view. I mean, from a South African context, it's like, remember the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, right? We are now trying to figure out how to absolve or salvage something that has been going on for decades, right? So someone listening is going to say, and I just like what you just said there, it's not about the fact that you can time transport yourself or teleport yourself into that individual's early stage life, but you can definitely make an impact by knowing that these things matter, and that when he's in your, under your wing at your organization, figure out a way to employment assistance programs, outreach programs, figure out a way to get this guy. And that word vulnerability also tells me organizationally that you need to figure out a way to have a communication that allows them to see that you actually care, that you actually empathize. I think there's power in what you just said. Now, of course, I would love to get into more detailing how exactly we could do that. But in the work that you do, and you do work a lot of work across partnerships, innovation, education, and systems change, what gives you hope when you think about building more equitable futures for young people? Where's that hope? What's the sliver of hope that you want to share with us?
Sorry, Deepak?
I'll repeat that question for you. I'm just asking, you know, you work across you work across partnerships, innovation, education, and systems change, right? What gives you hope? Because there's a lot of things that are going on, right? But what gives you hope when you think about building more equitable futures for young people?
What gives me hope is that I see, I interact with youngsters all the time in the work that I do, and I see their curiosity, and I also see parents and caregivers wanting more for the children in their care. And this makes them highly motivated. And it's really remarkable to see how resilient people are when they want a better life.
When they
want, always hear stories about immigrant families and people coming from all over wanting a better life. And that still exists. And that gives me hope.
I'm with you. From a pure funding point of view though, right? I mean, there have to be certain challenges that make you sometimes wonder why you do what you do. What have you realized about funding and, you know, getting people's focus and agenda on something like this? And I ask because some of my listeners are really, it's not just a conversation about connecting the dots to careers, but it's also about how do business leaders listening in actually realize that there's a need and there's a demand to help and support organizations like yours and the work that you do. So give me a feel about how funding rates go, how challenging is it, and where you feel that there could be more support coming from the corporate world.
Fundraising is a very, very challenging thing to do, whether it's for a startup or for a social impact organization. And I think, Deepak, the reason for that is complex. Firstly, it's around awareness. Also, then there are certain fads that enter the social impact space where people decide we need to be putting our money on this and that. When something becomes, you know, attractive and it becomes fashionable, a lot of money will go into one area. So, like, you're basically like a brand vying for attention, and that can be very challenging. But what I do and what I find is all successful business, all successful relationships are trust-based. And so my work lies in building trust-based relationships. And when I do that, I have success in funding.
That's interesting, because I really like the angle on trust. So assuming that it's trust, but what is the general competition when you speak about the problems or the things that you're trying to solve for, right, Kang, are things that are not just foundational, but they've also been around for a long time. When you talk about fads, is money now going towards more fancy things like, you know, AI education for teenagers, you know, computing labs for teenagers and stuff like that? Are those what you would call as fads?
I wouldn't consider those fads, because there is there's a real need for digital literacy to support youngsters. But if you look at the research that we've done, for example, in early childhood development, what's happening is that Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, he's one of South Africa's Nobel Peace Prize laureates, had a famous saying where he said, "Don't fish someone out of the water downriver, but rather find out why they fell in the first place. And that's the problem when we are putting our money at skills development in the later years and not concentrating on the early years, because now we already have a brain that doesn't know how to learn, and we're throwing all this money and resources at that instead of looking at the remedial and developmental work required to get that brain hardwired for learning. So yes, it is a challenge. It is a challenge because you have to educate people.
Yeah. In fact, as you were talking, I just got this weird image of humans digging a hole in the sand. And the sand is so dry that the hole keeps filling up with all the effort. And it just hit me. And I work with 21, 28-year-olds today, and you're actually giving me a good caution there. That sometimes that feeling that you have, Deepak, where you feel that the sand is falling back upon you is simply because you built on a foundation that was already very weak. What needed to have happened in terms of investment should have happened earlier. Now this foundation has arrived and you're trying to build a skyscraper on it, and that is the result you see. That's very interesting. I'm actually very intrigued by that point of view that you just shared with us. Ma'am, last very short question to you. What is the single biggest thing that organizations still misunderstand when it comes to talent development and human potential in today's workforce? A quick synopsis would be great from you.
I think that they misunderstand how they should be communicating with their employees. And I think that the internal processes do not allow, as I said earlier in this conversation, for people to stand up and say, I'm struggling with this. I really need support. I don't really understand Absolutely. What I'm doing. And I think the more we create space for that, the more successful.
Correct. I like the use of the word space. I think it is psychological, safe, vulnerability, everything matters. Developing talent is the ultimate capital investment, not a variable business expense. And I think that's a very key point that I've just learned. To build a future-proof enterprise, leaders must actively engage with the broader systems that prepare individuals to step into the commercial world. Hey, stay tuned. The fun's about to end, but it's still one more segment. Our final segment is going to translate some of these insights that Kayang has shared with us into actionable guidance for your own career path. And that's coming up next. Thanks for listening.
We'll be right back with real stories, fresh insights, and action steps to help you rise up at work without losing yourself. You're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Your ambition built your success, but somewhere along the way, your ambition took over and started running you. Hi, I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra. I'm an executive coach, sales strategist, and host of Rise Up at Work. I've spent 3 decades inside corporate walls, a long time. I've been witness to how pressure rewrites purpose. And when you lose sight of purpose, how the right mindset can help you reset and write a greater story. Rise Up at Work premieres soon on Now Media Television. Remember, it's time to move from surviving to thriving. It's time to rise up at work. And we're back. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra, and you're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Let's keep reclaiming your career and learning how to truly rise up at work.
Welcome back to the final segment of Rise Up at Work. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra. I am sitting down with strategic human capital leader Kayang Gagliano. Today we have mapped out quite a lot in this comprehensive conversation we've had. We've discussed long-term organizational and personal optimization, but we also looked at why human growth matters beyond the classroom. We both actually had a great conversation, and I had a very sinking feeling that as we in the corporate world onboard these individuals, not only is our onboarding weak as per Kayang, but the reality is that you're already onboarding someone that may have a weak framework and you're going to build something on that. Building a career on something that is very foundational and not solid is like the proverbial digging a hole in the sand keeps falling back. And that visual is still haunting me. Now we're going to bring our focus back to the individual viewer. We're going to talk about navigating uncertainty. We're going to talk a little bit about identity and ambition in a rapidly changing world that requires a continuous willingness to learn, then kind of unlearn, and then adapt. To truly reach your full professional potential, I think we need to actively ground ourselves in curiosity and human connection. Kayang, last segment, I really want to close by providing our viewers with the actionable guidance needed to stay adaptable and to thrive in modern life. So I want to start off, and this is a question that I really enjoy asking many of the guests that come on my show. If a 21-year-old were entering the workforce today, what is the single biggest piece of advice you would give them that would benefit them for the rest of their careers?
Keep learning in your own time and stay curious. I mean, this is what you have been speaking to, but it is so important. In order to be adaptable, you have to be curious. And how do you cultivate curiosity? Again, you give yourself permission to play. So you go out there and you cultivate a learning mindset in yourself. It can be very overwhelming. So speak to your passions and the things that matter to you and read about them. Research, make the time to listen to podcasts. And I think if you do that, you are going to find a way to stay adaptable and to build resilience within your career.
Here's a challenge I'm going to throw back at you, Karen. You know, I work with these 21-year-olds, and the first thing they tell me is, hey, boss, you want me to listen to a podcast for 40 minutes? It's too much. I don't have that much time. TLDR, right? I mean, too little time, and we need to just give me something short to do. Kayang, what is a practical idea that you think works when someone tells you that I don't, just don't have time to do this? What advice would you give to someone like that listening in right now?
To have a notebook and a pen and to write notes and to doodle. So a very interesting study came out in the last month where a neuroscientist looked at the difference between typing on a keyboard and doing handwriting. And what they discovered is that they, you know, they did a brain imaging and they discovered that so many parts, so many different brain centers light up when we do handwriting. So I know that sounds kind of silly, but it's a brilliant hack for keeping your brain alive. It's simply writing little notes or doing little doodles. Keep a notebook, keep a pen, and just jot down ideas, thoughts, and little pictures.
I am a huge fan of exactly what you said. I always tell people, one of the things that I've noticed that people come into meetings with notebooks and take notes on notebooks. And I actually still walk in with my little, either, you know, the A5 little spiral book thingy with a pen. And people get very confused. The reality is that when you write, there's this, I don't know how to explain it to you, Kang, but I kind of feel where you're going with this. There's this tactile relationship you develop. I also realize that when I read books, I tend to keep my fingers on the page. As your fingers move over that, those words, not because I'm reading Braille or something, it's just that you feel a difference. I don't know how to say this, but I just remember reading another neuroscience article, why food tastes different when you eat it with your hands versus eating with a fork. And I actually said to myself, wow, that makes a lot of sense. That does make a lot of sense because I have actually experienced that. And then, of course, I mentioned this to my cousin who promptly, while having dinner that night, started just violently, you know, sucking on the fingers and everything just to tell me that, yeah, you're right. And I realized they're making a joke of it. But anyway, Kang, coming back to this conversation, right? We have spoken about a 21-year-old who's entering the workforce. I think they've got some meaning. You've given them a very good, simple idea. Let's just expand this list a little bit, right? You spoke about mindset and a growth mindset. What mindset, if you could expand on the growth mindset or a habit, do you believe would help people stay curious, adaptable, and emotionally grounded as they grow older? As you grow older, how do you keep this work that you have just said a 21-year-old should do? Now he's 25, now he's 26. How do you make, keep that engine running? How do you keep that blade sharpened?
By reading. And it doesn't matter if you just read a paragraph a day, keep reading. Right. It's how we build our vocabulary. It's how we understand the structure of language. And it is how we are exposed to new ideas.
It's really interesting because, you know, there's this notion. The second you say read, people immediately think of thick books, right? Or a library. And I think that it was very important that you added there. It could be a paragraph. And it could also just be your Twitter feed. I don't know. But as long as you're reading and you're absorbing and you're seeing the world from a different lens, I think that's the point you're making, right? If one, if one were to talk about reading, right? Kayang, is there any specific type of reading that you've noticed helps with developmental activities? So I'm not asking this question on behalf of a parent, right? Who, what do they get the child to read and stuff? But let's assume I'm 21-year-old and I've got a weak foundation. What type of stuff do you think helps a 21-year-old when it comes to reading? The classics, essays, poems, or am I simplifying this way too much?
I think we don't have to be that prescriptive about what we read. It really is just about engaging with text, or you were saying people don't have time to listen to a podcast, but it's about engaging with ideas. And then the next step is to have a conversation with someone else about those ideas. Because it is when we exchange knowledge and when we debate that those neurons really start firing and when we question our preconceived ideas. And I think that if you keep doing that, you you read something or you're exposed to something, even if it's a TikTok video, if you then have a conversation around what's taking place with someone else or a few different people, you will keep learning. You will be stimulated.
It just hit me. You're actually correct. I also realize that it's not the reading element only. It's the read to engage element that makes something so powerful to stick. I mean, the joy of reading a book, reading something that you disagree with or something you agree with, but you have this urge to share, right? It's like watching a good movie or a bad movie. You want to do word of mouth. You go and tell your friends, you know what? I saw a movie. It was really bad. Don't spend your money on it. You just watched a movie. Same parallel then. If you've read something, go ahead. Share, engage, have a discussion. I like that idea. Read to engage is the connection that I was missing potentially, right? We tell people to read. We don't necessarily tell them what to do after reading. It makes it sound like, you know, I want you to read and then sit there like a philosopher scratching your beard, thinking about the world. And I really like the point you made there. It's not that. It's actually reading to then engage with other people to share. And I have always said this, sharing is not just about caring, but sharing actually delivers return on investment. You broaden your perspective because someone, and if that person is the right someone you're talking to, is going to share right back also, right? And Kang, that's dialogue, right? Not a monologue anymore. I like that idea. And I think I just also found the segment title, right? Read to engage. Thanks for that, ma'am. So let's start getting into the personality side of things, right? Now, adults also need to relearn, right? They also need to think about creativity, play, or the human connections that they may have missed upon when they were, but you could do something, you could salvage it, right? What do you personally think adults need to relearn about creativity, play, or human connection in order to thrive in modern life with the AI onslaught, with our love for devices?
I think that we need to destigmatize being a little silly. I know that sounds like a strange way to be framing this, but I think that in the world of work and in the world of business, there's a lot of masking. I spoke to that earlier, that takes place because of how we think we need to show up. And I think that with the Me Too movement and with what has been deemed perhaps negatively woke culture, there's a lot more awareness around toxic behavior that we weren't even aware was toxic. But part of that is shaming silliness or goofiness or playfulness. And I think that a really good way to tap back into play is to remind ourselves that we can be a little silly. We can be a little off center. And I think that is very good for us to do that. And it doesn't have to be in the workplace. It can be at home. But we need to create and see games because they're all around us.
No, I like that because to me, I'm a big proponent of levity. I do believe that levity works and you can use humor to actually diffuse situations as well. And I like the fact that you can combine that with play and make some logical conclusion to it. Kang, what I wanted to do is I kind of want to give you an opportunity because, you know, we have had an exceptionally clear and valuable masterclass, right? You have tremendous insights into talent transformation, systems change, and human capability. And I think our audience has got some really good nuggets there. I will absolutely, when this is released, add to that in terms of my own writing to give a flavor of what I took away from this, right? Because I literally think that we've got a playbook that I could populate from the work we've just discussed and done, right? Last question is, and I'd like to really give you an opportunity to tell me more about the work that you do. And if people listening in want to continue learning from your work and want to follow the work that you are doing and what you're building, where can they find you and how do they connect with you? And just tell us where, if someone is interested in finding out whether they could contribute or fund, how would that process look like?
Well, Deepak, thank you very much for the opportunity to tell the viewers a little bit more about what I do. So firstly, they can find me on LinkedIn. That's always the easiest, Kayanga Giano. And then I would be able to take the conversation from there. But to speak to the work we do, if I had to really sum it up, we work with a lot of tech platforms, but the most exciting one for us in South Africa is WhatsApp. And the reason for that is because WhatsApp, you don't require a lot of data. And it's also the most widely used social media platform in South Africa. And so what we're really trying to do, Deepak, is to leverage the equitability of WhatsApp as a platform in order to put really high value educational content, but also multilingual content onto WhatsApp, which includes translated audio clips. Because in a country like South Africa, we are sitting with extremely low literate audiences. So if we have people that can actually listen to audio and video clips in their mother tongue, we are going to be able to do amazing things in this country. And it really, really excites me. And that is why I am so passionate about the work that I do.
Clearly you are. Kang, it was a pleasure having you. I'm going to wrap this segment up. I think that we are at a very important discussion. I actually want everyone listening in to actually realize you need to take complete ownership of your professional trajectory. And a lot of us think that that professional trajectory started at age 21 or 22. And I think the reality is it started earlier. Those listening in, look at your younger brothers, your younger sisters, look at people around you and start asking a simple question. What can we do with some of these teenagers, some of these children to make them better professionals as they grow up? Not because they're going to be fed into a cattle, you know, they're not a herd or a cattle, because they're individuals, they're human beings. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra, and I'll see you next time on Rise Up at Work.